and thank you for joining me. This is Out to Lunch, the place where famous people learn to talk with their mouths full. I choose the food, we eat, and we chat. My guest today has spent the last few years being scared of aliens, dinosaurs, and friendly giants. When he's not acting in front of a green screen on Jurassic Park, Men in Black, or the BFG, he's wowing theatre audiences. He's worked with Spielberg, Tarantino, and Edgar Wright, and is now the star of Apple TV's Trying. It's the brilliant actor, Rafe Spall.
I was playing the lead part and Sophie Okonedo was in it too. We did the read through. I stumbled through it. And then afterwards, the director came and said, well, that didn't go well, did it? He said, what's the problem? I said, I fucking told you, I can't do this. And he said, it's probably best you leave, isn't it? And I said, really? He said, yeah, I think it is. I said, but my bag's still in the other room with all the guys. I've got to go and get it.
I have to say, Rafe, you have a proper cocktail cabinet. I'm really impressed by your cocktail cabinet.
It's had a lot of use over the last 18 months, let's put it that way.
Has it? Have you been spanking the cocktail cabinet?
Yeah. Absolutely. Mullering, I think, is the technical phrase.
Listen, thank you so much for agreeing to do this. I hope the... we'll get onto the food in a minute. I decided before watching you eat, it might be fun to watch you get eaten. Mm. So I watched Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom. Have you seen it yet? Because you once said you hadn't.
No,
you
still not in its entirety, no. I've not seen it all the way through. The first time that my son saw it, my seven-year-old boy, no one had told him that I get eaten by a T-Rex.
Oh, spoiler alert.
Come on.
Rafe plays the baddie.
Yeah.
There are T-Rexes. He's going to get eaten at the end. Okay.
Exactly. And he burst into tears. And then when he got back, he asked me how I escaped from the animal's stomach. And I said, no, darling, it's a film. It's not really. You went, yeah, but how did you escape? what did you do? Was it a sword? Yes, it was a sword that I cut myself out of, yeah.
Well, I think you can just take that as a testament to your acting. There was a moment in there, in that film, in which you play opposite another great British villain, Toby Jones. And the two of you are doing impeccable American accents against each other. And I often, when I watch something like that, I think to myself, do you ever worry what every other American actor is thinking when these two British bastards turn up and take their jobs?
Yeah, absolutely. It's weird. It's odd. And also, we were filming it in Pinewood, these two Englishmen doing these slightly ropey American accents in these huge sets. It's weird. And to be honest, Jay, I've found myself doing American accents quite a lot recently, and I find it a dreadful pain in the ass. It's actually, I did a film called Just Mercy where I played the district attorney of Alabama, and I had to do a southern accent, and that's something you can get your teeth into. But that sort of general American accent that was required for Jurassic Park, it's harder than it looks. And you're always having to think about it. Whenever I do an accent and I'm acting, 90% of me thinking about the accent. That's it.
Do you get access to a voice coach?
You do. But then you end up sort of playing to them. The MO is like pleasing the accent coach.
Well, listen, you can talk in model's own voice today.
Thank you very much.
There are two subjects you always say you're going to get asked about. One is food and weight, and the other one is your dad. So let's get through them.
Let's do it.
You've said that trying not to watch what you eat to keep your weight down, there's nothing sexy about that.
I don't know. Is dieting the opposite of sex? Something has to be. I imagine it's that. I imagine that watching what you eat are those things. And I've always had to watch what I eat because I was a fat child and all the way up through my sort of early 20s. And then I lost a great deal of weight, which wasn't easy. Look, I love food. I love eating. I love restaurants. I love boozing and eating sort of, I don't know, ordering a bit of steamed fish and broccoli. It's just not sexy stuff. Oh, is it?
You're speaking to the converted here.
I'm aware of your journey. And I know that we have a few things in common, famous parents and losing weight. So there you go.
Well, listen, the starter provided by Lisa Goodwin-Allen, head chef of Northcote Manor, is, I think we can mark this one up as just pure flavour, which is you have asparagus. Let me read the full title. It's char-grilled Yorkshire asparagus with sheep's curd, sorrel, pesto, and there's a sourdough crumb.
Indeed.
How did your plating go?
I think pretty good. I love cooking, and I like sort of.
All right,
making
so
things
so,
look
when,
nice,
when, so when this was proposed to you, it wasn't, oh God, I've got to do this. This is fun.
Really fun, really fun. And I've always wanted to put micro herbs on something. It's the sort of thing you only see on MasterChef.
Let's crack on. And you have a bottle of claret.
Yeah, I changed because on the email I said to you that I was going to drink a Roc de Calm, I think, and then I went down and pull it up and I drank it all. So I've it is another claret. It's a Margaux. It's a Brand Centignac.
A cheeky little Margaux.
Because I've just sort of got into wine. Because I moved to the country and there was a wine cellar. It's a rectory and downstairs is a wine cellar. It was all racked out, so I thought I'd better fill it with wine.
So are you now sort of doing proper research and trying to educate yourself on this stuff?
Yeah, but it's so. I mean, is it deliberately exclusive wine? Is that does it try to make it difficult for you?
Well,
do you know what I mean?
There's an interesting conversation. There's a great restaurant in, there are two now, called Noble Rot, and it grew out of a magazine called Noble Rot, which does a brilliant job of demystifying wine.
Yeah, quite right. But it's the fact that French wines never put the grape variety on the bottle, do they? That's what's so nuts. And then the fact that you've got the appellation and you've got the chateau, you've got the areas. It's really... It makes it difficult. And I've sort of gone some way out of my way to try and learn a bit about it. And, you know, I'm still stuck in the clarets, really.
Well, I think it's a good place to be. We share something, which is we are, you know, the children of people who were well known, where my case were. I cross-referenced two Wikipedia entries to discover one brilliant detail, which is you were born in 1983, exactly the same year your dad, Timothy Spall, really jumped into public consciousness through Auf Wiedersehen, Pet.
I was born during the first series of Auf Wiedersehen, Pet. Yeah, indeed.
The entirety of your childhood and growing up, he was already that thing.
Yeah. People would often come up to him in restaurants. He was famous. And I've never known any different. And now, I mean, I'm not as famous as my dad was. Because, you know, we forget that when Auf Wiedersehen, Pet was on, there was only a few channels. I mean, 20 million people used to watch it. It was a big deal. And it was also, you know, one of the first dramas about working class people, working class men. He was remains to be extremely loved and very popular. It was just always a thing that I've grown up with. And now I'm on telly and my kids are very unimpressed.
Well, there's one particular image that you've described of early acting lessons being sitting on the sofa while your dad shouted at the TV.
Yeah. Because I didn't get into drama school. My dad went to RADA, and in fact, he had a thing called the Bancroft Gold Medal, which was awarded to the most promising actor at the end of the year of RADA. It doesn't exist anymore. And that was on the wall. He won. And so I thought that I would audition for RADA and obviously get in. And I did audition and didn't get in. And so I never ended up going to drama school. I went to the National Youth Theatre, which was really sort of transformational for me. But my sort of taste was born out of him shouting at Lovejoy.
Was it?
Not specifically Lovejoy, but I was just thinking of a sort of 80s television show that might have irked him.
But what was it about acting? Or was it just that was the family business? That's what you did.
Hang on a second. This dog is...
Oh, there's annoying. A dog. Oh, excellent.
Yeah, a dog who nearly ate my main course. I was resting my meat just now, which isn't a euphemism.
And you got that before me.
I was literally resting my meat. And the dog is a Labrador puppy, was going for it. Anyway, why acting? It's a question I've asked myself a lot, and I've been asking myself in more detail recently. It's what my dad did. I always wanted to do it. I've always had a great passion for it.
Was there a school production that you did or something where you went?
No, I was in Bugsy Malone. I was in Bugsy Malone. I played Fat Sam, obviously.
Of course.
And one of the prettiest girls in the year called my house afterwards, called Tilly, and asked me to be her boyfriend. And I thought, well, this is for me, because girls were never interested in me. And then I did that, and I got a girlfriend out of it. So I thought, I'm gonna stick with it.
I have to refer back to your dad for one last time, and I promise I'll leave it there. Only because I think you'll like this, which is that there is a scene that he did which is regarded as totemic and has been referred to by almost all restaurant critics over the years.
Yeah, I know the one you mean.
You know the one I mean. It's in Life is Sweet, the 1990 Mike Leigh film, And I literally had to look up the menu because I've referred to it in reviews. Kidney bolognese, king prawn in jam sauce, chilled brains, prune quiche, that's one for our vegetarian friends, black pudding and camembert soup, which actually doesn't sound too bad to me, if I'm totally honest. Saveloy on a bed of light cheese, and then the absolutely, the most legendary of them all, which was pork cyst.
Yes. Yes. And can you remember the name of that restaurant?
Oh, no, I can't.
It was the Regret Rion.
That's it. I regret absolutely everything.
Yeah, exactly. And there's a great scene when he has the opening and no one turns up and he ends up crying in his pants.
He does. He does. Yeah. Did any of those scenes become part of the kitchen table conversation?
No. Because obviously I know the way that Mike Lee works. I know that it's based on improvisation. I know they're all from my dad's brain.
Yeah.
The sentence, pork cyst, could exist in very few people's mouths outside of Timothy Spall. It's very, very him.
How are you getting on with your starter?
I've finished it.
We both worked out that it was going to take a 5-minute break to slice the beef, warm the sauce. I've plated most of mine.
Yeah.
So should we take a quick break to create the wonder of our main course?
Yeah, I'll go and do it now. I'll be back in a sec. All right, mate. Hello, sir.
Hello. The main course, as people like to know, by Lisa Goodwin-Allen, is roasted beef, gremolata crust, beef fat chip, smoked garlic, and this sauce with turnips and capers and bacon in it. Does look pretty fabulous. And the
absolutely.
How did you find the instructions?
Very easy. Very easy to follow. And so this place is in Lancashire.
It is in Lancashire.
Am I right in thinking? Yeah. And it's a hotel and it's got a star, is it? One or two stars?
It's got a star, yeah. It's got a star. It's been there a very long time. It's been in a number of people's hands. And Lisa Goodwin-Allen was the head chef under Nigel Howarth. They were one of the first entrants into the meal kit business, and I think they've done it better than almost anybody else. So listen, you don't get into drama school, but you do National Youth Theatre, which is a launch platform for enormous numbers of people, that names that people would recognise over the years. This is going to sound like a criticism, but it's not. Yeah. I'm just curious whether over the years, because you didn't have those 3 years at Lambda or RADA or Central or all of that, whether in the early days there were times when you'd walk into a rehearsal room wondering if you were going to get found out.
Yeah, I did my learning whilst getting paid and public. Like I still now you feel so alone. I mentioned that I played the district attorney of Alabama, and I was on this film set with Michael B. Jordan and Jamie Foxx and in a courtroom, and I had to do this speech in a Southern accent, and no one had heard me do it because I hadn't auditioned. I was sitting there for the first rehearsal. First time anyone had heard me do it, 150 extras from the South. We were shooting in Atlanta, and I looked down and my tie was visibly moving because my heart was going so much. And you really have to fight the urge to just leave. You're just going to go, I'm just going to leave. I'm just going to walk away. I'm just going to go. And you feel so alone. You go, fuck it. I'm just going to back myself. Go strong and wrong. Whatever it is, just go for it. You still do it now. Still now.
Well, you get nerves or you...
Being fired, the ignominy of being fired. Because
have
it's
you
been? So. I have. I got fired once from a radio play.
Oh.
It was a Jacobean play. I can't remember what it was. And I said, I can't speak verse. I've never been taught. And they said, come along. You'll be absolutely fine. I get there, and the other actors are Rory Kinnear, a guy called Jonathan Slinger, and Bertie Carville, who are probably our three great classical actors.
Yeah.
I was playing the lead part, and Sophie Okonedo was in it too. We did the read through. I stumbled through it. And then afterwards, the director came and said, well, that didn't go well, did it? He said, what's the problem? I said, I fucking told you, I can't do this. And he said, it's probably best you leave, isn't it? And I said, really? He said, yeah, I think it is. I said, but my bag's still in the other room with all the guys. I've got to go and get it. So then I had to walk in and sort of go, I've been fired. I'm going to go. But you know what I did after that? I paid for 10 lessons of verse speaking Shakespeare for myself with this acting teacher, even though I've never done it since. And I've really got no interest in doing Shakespeare, but it was it put hairs on my chest, Joe, yeah.
Have you come across, you must have come across Rory Kinnear, Bertie Carvel since?
Yeah, I have.
Were they supportive?
No. I think they relished it, as I probably would, to be perfectly honest with you. I think Gore Vidal said about it, someone clever said that there's nothing quite like a slight misfortune besetting one of your friends. It's sort of an evil thing to say, but... with acting. It's what you do when you're an actor and you see a review. You scan it for your friend's name. You see what they say about it, and that's it.
The one little detail, this just seems unfair, which is you're named Rafe after a part that your father had played very famously in The Night of the Burning Pestle, and then you did the same part.
I took it on, Jay, yeah. he did this play called The Night of the Burning Pestle. My mum was in the audience in the Royal Shakespeare Company in the early 80s, and it was one of his biggest early successes. He got nominated for an Olivier, and my mum fell in love with him. 6 months later, they got married, then they had me. They called me Rafe after the character. So then I got asked to do that play when I was 21, 22 at the Barbican. And I did it, and it was a flop. In fact, the headline in The Guardian was a big picture of me with a sort of comedy arrow through my head, one star, and the headline, A Turkey for Christmas. You can't have things go your way too much early on, can you? It's not good for you.
But the remarkable thing is, and now we need to say, you've done many, many brilliant, brilliant roles, which have been, you know, adored by lots of people. You've had great associations with the likes of Edgar Wright and his trilogies, which I love.
Yeah.
Just in the past year, you've done an astonishing one-man show at the National.
Yeah, that sent me half mad.
Well, let's talk about that briefly, because, I mean, it's leaping through the chronology, but Death of England... Yeah. Is a one-man show which sort of managed to get on the stage during the pandemic.
Just before.
Was it just before? Or maybe they put it out, they streamed it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Sort of about white Englishness, written by a couple of black British writers and directors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was just watching your the funeral sequence. Mm. You have described it recently as acting with a capital A.
Yeah, it bloody was, yeah.
But it's immense.
Did it do
your head in?
Yeah, I didn't. And it's taken me a year since doing it to realise in what way it did.
Well, tell me, in what way was
it? Well, it was a big deal for me. It was one man show in the National Theatre. I'd always grown up with sort of worshipping the National Theatre, and it was an hour and 40 minutes long. It was 16,000 words. To put that in context, the part of Hamlet is 6,000 words, right? So it's nearly three times. And I played five different characters, and it was incredibly physical, emotional thing about grief, sort of the disenfranchisement of the white working class and modern day multiculturalism. It was a big success, which was great.
Well, you were staggering in it.
But what's interesting about that is that you spend your life pursuing success, great reviews, whatever it is. I got those reviews that start once in a generation and in 30 years of reviewing, right? The things that you sort of fantasize about. And it made me feel no better. It didn't answer any questions. And you spend your life going, if I just get that recognition, if I just get that amount of money, if I just lose that amount of weight, that fantasy came true. And I got to the end of the rainbow, and there wasn't gold, there was nothing, ashes. And so you realize that you need a big recalibration. And it's still the thing I'm most proud of. It answered questions for me. It made me go, this isn't everything, this acting game. Because you can get quite myopic about it. And if you're ambitious, like I have been, you think the answers lie there. But it turns out they don't at all.
Hello, it's Ollie here. I'm the executive producer on Out to Lunch. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Now, one of the relationships I'm proudest of in my life is with my daughters. They're not quite the age to go for fancy lunches with celebs yet, but we do enjoy our family dinners together in relative harmony. You know, give us time, that they are still quite young. But this takes work, and it's a mistake to think that relationships have to be easy to be right. The best relationships come out of learning to live with each other and keeping our sense of humour, even when food is spilt all over the table or dinner's not to everyone's liking. It can be really tricky, but therapy can help you with those skills. You can work through parenting challenges, explore seeing eye to eye as a couple, and work through your relationship with yourself too. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's flexible, and you can switch therapists at any time, as that's a relationship that needs to be the right fit too. Become your own soulmate, whether you're looking for one or not. Visit betterhelp.com/outtolunch today and get 10% off your first month.
Every day in America, 60 million packages are delivered, but we don't always know what's inside.
He bent down to pick the package up. That's when the device detonated.
Danger is everywhere, and no one is safe in Austin, Texas, as law enforcement hunts a serial bomber for 19 days. From Sony Music Entertainment, Campside Media, and Pegalo Pictures, this is Witnessed. 19 Days. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts to binge all episodes or listen weekly wherever you get your podcasts.
You, as you've said, moved to the country. When we were working out how to get the food to you, I went on Street View and basically I was on the bit of the map that says here be dragons. was that a particular decision to do with your kids getting to a certain age or wanting to escape the pressure cooker of London, which for an actor can be quite intense?
To be honest, I just sort of went along with it. And now I've ended up in this strange corner of the Stroud Valleys. Actually, you reviewed a restaurant near me.
Nailsworth, yeah. Isn't it?
Yeah.
Wild Garlic.
Wild Garlic. They've opened a sort of fancier one, a sort of tasting menu gaff called Wilder, which we went to once, which was excellent. But restaurants in the country, you want places that you can go to weekly. And I don't really want to take on a tasting menu weekly.
No, that is one of the problems. You see all over the Lake District, for example, it's full of multi-Michelin-starred restaurants and very short on somewhere you can just pop out for supper.
But that's my thing with village. As I've alluded to earlier, I've got a real fantasy about having a restaurant or a pub or whatever. And it's just, if I was to open a pub in the country, I'd do one thing really well. Just do a great burger. Just keep it simple. And that would be my blueprint if I were to open a pub in this sort of area.
I'm not going to advise you to get into the hospitality business, Rafe, because despite everything you say, I do think the acting lark is going rather well for you.
Yeah, I suppose so. To be good at anything now, it's going to take years. I've only just got good at this, which is probably why I'm sick of it.
I mean, I said I wasn't going to go there, but I am going back again. Yeah. Have you looked for approval from the actor at, back at the parental home?
He's always been extremely supportive.
You have worked together, haven't you? Well, on Room with a View.
Yeah, in a sort of ITV adaptation of a Room with a View, which was nice. But I was a young man, I was in my early 20s. But I've been developing a show with Sky, set in the world of top level boxing, because I'm a huge boxing fan, about boxing promotion for my dad and I, because I'd love to do a proper thing with him.
Coming up, because it's just dropped, which is Trying for Apple TV. Season one, I think, was
Last May,
and now season two is coming within a matter of weeks from where we are now, isn't that right?
Indeed.
Now, I have to admit, I've talked briefly about this, and I won't go into detail, I don't have to watch Trying because I lived it in exactitude, so IVF and adoption, so I've been there.
Wow.
So I wish everybody else who watches it absolute, the best of times. I probably won't because I saw the whole movie and, in fact, I took the starring role. But when you're preparing for something like that, can you just read the script and turn up?
No, I'm not a big researcher. Not because I'm lazy. If it benefits, I do it. If it doesn't, then I don't. And the guy who wrote it, Andy Walton, was himself adopted.
Right, okay.
So he was always there as
he had skin in the game.
Yeah, had massive skin in the game and was always very helpful. And to me, the MO on this show was just painting a picture of two very believable people. I'm in it opposite a fantastic actress called Esther Smith. My sort of concentration on that was just trying to make it real, watchable and lovely.
What did you do to work on that relationship? Did you get together before you started shooting?
Yeah, we did. And, the chemistry is either there or it isn't. And you do one of those sort of dreaded chemistry tests, not with Bunsen burners, but as in,
Well, unless you really hate them. But
Yeah, exactly. Yes, you really hate them. It's what I mean about sort of getting control of acting is that you realise that what's good acting is being alive in the moment. And so to engender that, you need to get yourself into a very relaxed, creative space. And that's what I always try and concentrate on. So everything on a film set tries to make you as tense as possible. So you've got a camera on you, you've got 200 people in a room doing their business, and then the first assistant director essentially says, right, everyone, shut up! Okay, go!
Now do something everyone, really close and emotional.
Exactly, and then everyone looks at you. And then even the very word action makes you believe that you need to do something action-packed, right? So what I now do is, what I've done for a few years, is it's when they put the board on, the slate, and everyone starts to be quiet, I sing over the board. I love Prince, so I'll sing Prince to myself quite loudly, just to break it up, just to sort of claim that space and be as relaxed as possible. Because I think that's where good acting comes from, being relaxed.
I have to say, if anybody wants another story about this, go back and listen to the Jason Isaacs episode of Out to Lunch, where he tells a superb story about Richard Harris doing head in by doing nothing for about 2 minutes after someone had called action.
Yeah. That's fantastic, though. I get it. It's very easy to seize up. You get take tension. You really get take tension. And many actors will tell you that they do have given all their best performances off screen. Because, you know, when you shoot a scene, you'll point the cameras one way at one person, then turn them around and do the scene again and point them at you. You always feel so much more bloody relaxed when the cameras aren't pointing at you. So if you can get that same energy across when you're on screen, that's when it's, I think, you know, pleasurable to be in and great to watch.
So I have to ask you, therefore, about the Chatterley affair. Was that your first, your only nude scene?
No. I couldn't sleep one night and I counted my sex scenes, Jay. I think I've done about 18 at last count. I've had my willy out a lot, too much, but I've stopped. I'm not doing it anymore.
Okay.
I've got kids in the playbook, you know, of age where their friends sort of talk to them about it in the playground. It's not good. It's wholly inelegant to get your willy out on telly. I mean, God, it's like what a strange. And then you do these, you know, it's like you've been doing a sex scene. Like, this is how I pay my mortgage. This is what I exchange for cash. A high point of the sex scenes in my life. My number one was probably with David Walliams. He played Frankie Howard, and I played his lifelong lover, Dennis. And David is become a great friend. He's a really lovely, loyal person. But part of his bit in life is being overtly flirtatious, right? That's part of it. That's part of his
and
shtick,
very fluid, right? Across the genders and everything.
Right, very fluid across the genders, and sort of, you know, that's part of his thing. But when it came to the sex scene, he was all scared. He was all afraid. Yeah, he bloody was. And because I'd done so many of them, and actually, I'd done, you know, the ones with David. I had to, what's the correct way of saying wank him off? I don't know. I had to wank him off.
That'll do. It's fine. Yeah. This is out to lunch and we use language like that. So you had to toss off David Walliams beneath
him. I had to toss him off for cash. Yeah. And then I had to kiss him, and then we had to do all sorts of things and get in a bath together. And And when you do a sex scene with a woman, I'm always acutely aware that you're in a room with predominantly men. So all of my concentration goes into trying to make it as comfortable as possible for her. With David Walliams, it was just like, fucking come here, you big dickhead. get over there, shut up. I'm hanging those boots up. I think I've had enough of that sort of thing.
Or to put another way, you're putting your pants back on.
Exactly. But to be fair, I don't get asked that much anymore, Jay.
Yeah, I've never been asked. Now, listen, how's your main course? Are you through?
It's finished, dispatched easily. I thought that sauce was absolutely fantastic.
It was
deep,
kind of
beautiful sauce.
One of those thick, glossy beef jus with little cubes of turnip and capers and bacon and all the good things. So dessert, and I have to say, they do these things. Have you got that with you, or is that over in the kitchen?
No, it's in the kitchen. I'll just go and get it.
All right, you go and get it, and then I can introduce it.
All right, great.
See you in a minute. Now, I have to say, Lisa Goodwin-Allen does amazing things when it comes to dessert. She's come up with a way of doing these individual ready-made items. Mm. So this is called Annabelle's Strawberries and Cream. So the thing you found in your little box is white chocolate, which has been dusted, I assume, using some sort of air gun. So it's red, looks like a red rose, in a bowl of almond cream. And I believe when you cut in, I say I believe because nobody can see what I'm doing while you're off. I did actually have a look inside. There's a liquid center. There's a sort of vanilla cream center. And then in the middle, there is a strawberry compote.
Jeez Louise.
How's your day going? Right.
I mean, this is a definite highlight of my week. This is fantastic. Thank you so much for sending this over. What a fabulous treat.
I also watched BFG.
Oh, yeah.
Partly because my neighbour is the BFG. Mark Rylance.
Oh, is he?
Yeah, he's only about 10 doors down.
Oh, I see.
And I loved seeing his animated face. But what struck me about that, so you have a great role in the Buckingham Palace scene towards the end.
Yeah.
But that's a lot of whiz-bangery, green screen and all that sort of stuff, which you've also done in Jurassic Park, you did in Men in Black. That's a very different acting discipline to the stage, isn't it?
Yeah, it's dreadful. It's crap.
And if any casting directors are listening...
Well, I'm available for hire. No, look, it's nice. It's all good fun. And actually, you know, the BFG was fantastic because it was Steven Spielberg. I mean, geez Louise. And there's a scene in that when I happened to be on a helicopter near the end and there was this massive crane shot that came through the window and onto a close-up on me and on this sort of big gimbal thing which moves about to me. You look like you're in the air. And I looked out of the window of this helicopter thing and by the monitor of Steven Spielberg, looking like Steven Spielberg, and I burst into tears because I was like, this is exactly what you imagine being an actor to be like when you're older. It was a really moving moment. And actually there wasn't, you know, obviously Mark was always on top of a very tall sort of ladder and you have to look up at him and with a sort of green morph
suit. Is that how it was done? He was there being Mark on the top of a ladder.
On a sort of a scaffold rig. Yeah, he'd be right up there. Things like Jurassic Park. Just before I get eaten in Jurassic Park, I go underneath a car, a Jeep, as a huge stampede of dinosaurs come running out towards me. And then they trample over the Jeep. I'm underneath it and I come out and then I get eaten by the T-Rex. My legs get devoured by two raptors. But
I like to think of you're in two servings, really. A bit like...
exactly. An amuse-bouche of a torso. And, but just to shoot that sequence, 3 seconds of screen time underneath the Jeep, that was 9 days of night shoots.
9 days?
Yeah, for a four-second moment, yeah.
Wasn't that extraordinarily tedious?
Yeah. Having to do this. Oh, God! Oh, bloody hell! Yeah.
That was an acting masterclass, I have to say. Thank you.
I told you, I've just got control of my craft, Shay. I finally figured out how to do acting. But look, it's all fun. It was all fun. It was all rather thrilling. And it's paid for the house that I'm sat in now. And, it was directed by J.A. Bayona, who's a fantastic Spanish horror film director. So you find something to love in everything that you do. But I have to say, I did Jurassic Park, Men in Black, then War of the Worlds for the BBC. So I spent best part of 2 years pretending to be scared of a tennis ball on a stick. And so then to do something like Trying with a real person in front of me.
Somebody with a pulse.
Yeah, someone with a pulse. And just doing the sort of stuff that I'd like to watch, you know. Those films, those big films, they're fantastic, fantastic entertainment. And, you know, they're... I think Scorsese may have been right when he said they're like sort of theme park rides. I've been in some of them, you know, they're great, but it's not how I like to pass my time, put it that way. It's really nice now to have this show coming out that I'm, it's the sort of thing that I genuinely watch.
Well, we have to talk about the next big thing that's coming up, which is when To Kill a Mockingbird comes into town.
Yes.
And you're going to be playing the lead.
Yeah, Atticus, Jesus. I'm not going to do that, Jay. Any ideas?
I saw To Kill a Mockingbird in New York.
Did you see Jeff Daniels or Ed Harris?
I saw Ed Harris do it.
Yeah.
And what's extraordinary about it is the thing you're led to believe is on stage you have to be a bit bigger for people to see it, but it's a very pared-back role.
Yeah, it is.
And yet it's also... you know, almost the crux. It's an amazing piece of writing as well and production. I wasn't sure how it was going to work on stage. Did you see it in New York?
No, I didn't. And I still can't quite figure out why I've been asked to do it. I think they might be expecting Ralph Fiennes to turn up on the first day of rehearsal. And whereas something like Death of England was very front-footed, it was a part and a play that I could bend to my will. This is something different. This is in service of a story. This is, you're not only playing a character, you're sort of embodying a American decency, I suppose. Whilst at the same time, playing a flesh and blood human who's a small town country lawyer. I'm not entirely sure how I'm going to go about it yet, but I've got some time, thankfully.
And there are ghosts on your shoulder because obviously Gregory Peck created a version of that role.
Well, Gregory Peck, and then on Broadway, the show that I'm going to open in London, it was Jeff Daniels did it first, and then Ed Harris, and now, to my mind, somewhat incongruously me. But I suppose someone's got to do it.
Rafe, this has been a theme for our entire lunch. I mean, if we were across a table properly, yeah, I would be filling your glass one more time and saying, are you seriously that suspicious of your own career?
You know what it is? You get to, you know, I'm maybe 40, not too long from now, and you get to this stage, I think it's just a matter of who's still left standing. If you're still going, then you know, the pool is smaller of people that you can be trusted with this sort of thing, I think. Definitely realistic. You've got to be realistic about your standing, your position.
For what it's worth, I'm looking forward to seeing you play Atticus Finch in To Kill a Mockingbird when it opens in, I think it's next year, isn't it? 2022.
Yeah, we start rehearsing in January, goes up in the first preview will be my 39th birthday.
Well, that's a perfect way to celebrate, isn't it? Before I wrap up, you did just say something. Do you think you have ever turned up for a job and they thought they were getting Rafe Fiennes?
No. But I think it's a matter of time. I do. I mean, there's only so many Rafes, even though he does not spell his name Rafe, does he?
No, we all know he mispronounces his name. We've known that for years, but he's so sort of from such a grand family that, do you want to tell him? I'm not going to tell him.
I think I did once. I think I might have been 15 and it said, hello, Ralph, I'm Rafe. Maybe that was a dream or a fantasy, but I've got a vague memory of it. But
you think you did?
I don't know. I think so. I don't know. I think I was a bit drunk.
Your dad and he would have been on the set of one of the Harry Potter films at the same time.
Yeah, they would have indeed. They would have indeed. But he's a good turn, isn't he, Rafe? He's terrific. But there's not many Rafes out there. People really struggle with my name. Really. Like, really. People will go, they'll sort of bottle it and say, excuse me, Rafe. It's just phonetic. It's like, do you know what's done me up is Cafe. So people call me Rafe.
Well, all that remains for me is to say, Rafe Spall, thank you for staying in for lunch with me. It has been a delight. It really has. And I think the next time we have to sit across a restaurant table, don't you?
I think it's only right. And I can't wait. And really, to the good people at the Northcote, is that what they're
called? Northcote Manor.
Yeah, Northcote Manor. That was really a first-rate lunch.
Well, doing nude scenes and being eaten by dinosaurs sounds like far too much hard work to me. I think I'll just stick to my day job. Thank you to Rafe for being such a good sport, and I cannot wait to see him in To Kill a Mockingbird. He will be magnificent. Thanks, of course, to the amazing chef Lisa Goodwin-Allen and the whole team at Northcote Manor, Lancashire, for their wonderful food boxes. You can find them at northcote.com. And if you want to thank us, please do rate, comment, and tell your friends about Out to Lunch. You can follow us wherever you get your podcast to receive freshly plated episodes the moment they're on the pass. Out to Lunch is a Something Else and Jay Rayner production. The music was written, arranged, and performed by me, Jay Rayner, and Robert Rickenberg. The recording and mix engineer was Josh Gibbs. Jemima Rathbone was assistant producer. The producer is Selena Ream, and the executive producer is Darby Doris. Additional production is from Steve Ackerman. Next time, it's one of the most successful Irish novelists of all time. It's Marianne Keyes.
He ordered it, and like, literally, layer upon layer of management came out to warn him not to have it. And I could hear this crunching noise, and it turned out to be not the coxcomb, it turned out to be Monge too, but like, you know, I was in the horrors from the whole thing.